Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik. This is Red Eyes Radio. The website is redeyescreations.com. Jay Dyer from Jay's Analysis is back with us today on the program for an extended segment on the Charleston shooting and the bigger picture on how the media, the cultural establishment, and the political elite are seeking to use Dylann Roof for their own gain. Welcome back, Jay. Good to have you with us again. Thank you for joining us today. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well. Thank you, Henrik.
You bet. So let's just kind of get right to the Charleston shootings here. We have a lot to discuss. Obviously, I think most people already have heard what has happened, but just let me do a quick recap here. So Thursday evening around 9 p.m., a little bit later, Dylann Roof, I think is his name, not Roof, but Roof is said to have shot nine black Americans at the Emmanuel AME Church on Calhoun Street, downtown Charleston. It's been said, of course, that the murders were racially motivated, and not shortly thereafter, a website was found, discovered. I'm still a bit fuzzy exactly how that was discovered with some domain tool, I think. But nonetheless, with that came, of course, a manifesto and conveniently a just zip file ready to go for a press release, a bunch of photos of Dylann Roof and with various kind of charged regalia, if you will. But there's a lot to say about the case, curiosities and some contradictions foremost. But I think more importantly later, I want to discuss how this is being used and how they're seeking to piggyback certain political issues on this. But Jay, what's your analysis so far?
Well, I wrote a piece that tried to look at what we knew as of yesterday in terms of the facts, what had come out. Sean Helton also did an excellent piece at 21st Century Wire, so used some of his research as well. And where we are is basically looking at the same patterns that we've seen in so many of these so-called mass shooting events. I would preface it by saying I agree with some of the insight that Dave McGowan has had, where he considers the possibility that perhaps the transition from the serial killer phenomena of the 70s and 80s maybe expired, ran its course. And so what needed to happen was a new domestic threat. And so the new domestic threat changed from the serial killer to the mass shooter. And the mass shooter has many functions in terms of the establishment or the state, corporate state structure as to what agendas they might have or how they might use it, which we can get into later. But I would say at this point, when I first saw this and started looking in the news and following reactions, looking at Twitter, the immediate reaction was just automatic labeling, plastering of white terrorist. So nobody even knew, you know, at that point who the suspect was or whether he was even guilty. It had already been declared with the prepackaged news setting, run ready to go, ready to roll out. White terrorists. We need a white terrorist now because the only terrorists are Muslims, and this is racist. And so now we need to include the white terrorists. So, setting aside the very few aspects that make this case unique, and I don't mean to de-emphasize those aspects. They're very important in terms of the white aspect this time. For the most part, these are the telltale signs of stagecraft. So that was my argument. And as we discussed last time with Charlie Hebdo, that does not necessarily mean that I am certainly proclaiming that I know for certain that no one was killed or that nothing actually happened or anything of that nature. From the vantage point of research and analysis, we take a skeptical standpoint and say, well, we don't know. But what we do know is what's come out in the past in regard to this curiously manufactured pattern that we consistently see. And so I list about six patterns that I've always seen in these cases from researching this kind of stuff for several years that somewhat matches up sort of to the false flag terror list that I gave last time when we were discussing Charlie Hebdo. Now, that does not mean that these are the only aspects or that this is some definitive official list that necessarily proves anything. It's merely an analysis of the patterns that are present. And so just like Breivik, just like Cho Sun-hui, just like James Holmes, Jared Loughner, we see in some way connections with the establishment in regards to this individual, Dylan Stormroof, which sounds like a fake name to me.
Convenient name, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought his middle name was not real first because of kind of the racially charged, connotation of the name. But it seems to be correct. I found a document for one of his prescriptions, so that seems to be correct.
Yeah, well, and I'm not saying that he's not real. I'm just saying that it's a curious name to choose if this said person was chosen. And so the way that we might find a connection to the establishment in this regard would be his imprisonment. And so he has apparently photos of him wearing his orange jumpsuit in prison. And I think you probably are very aware of the fact that many times prison is a good way to be recruited into working for law enforcement as a snitch, an informant, something like that. And that could go in many directions. We've seen this with many of the radical Islamic types who are radicalized in prison and then go into being utilized in something like the Nation of Islam or some bizarre, most likely a Fed-controlled group like that. So I think that's a suspect in this regard, his prison sentence or period. Or he was at least arrested for drugs, I think, was what was going on.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was meth and Suboxone, a couple of other interesting drugs, of course, which we can get to that a bit later.
Exactly. Well, that was going to be right coming up next was just that you're right here in a minute. But number two, I say that mainstream media seems to already have an on the spot, ready to go narrative that rolls out immediately. And in this case, it was.
I gotta say, Jay, I was very surprised at how. I know it's quick. Don't get me wrong. Just like with 9/11, all these other ones, but this one, it's almost like it's they have this kind of blank boilerplate template, kind of press release ready, and then they just kind of fill in the blanks of location and name, and then we're good to go.
It is, right? Yeah. It's a kind of a technology almost.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, I mentioned here, there's no mention in the media of his SSRI or drug use connections that were immediately made known. The mainstream media doesn't mention that because, of course, the pharmaceutical companies run ads on all the mainstream media networks. So the details then emerge, I say, in number three, and they have cartoonish manifestos, oftentimes rambling, nonsensical manifestos. And I realize there are, mentally unstable individuals out there, but is this just a trope? Do you have to create a manifesto if you're a masculer? I mean, everyone that's chosen for media focus has a manifesto, and I think that's always curious, especially the bizarre aspects of, say, Breivik's manifesto, which seemed to have been just maybe a cut-and-paste job of a bunch of other weird manifestos, which, again, makes it highly suspect and questionable. And they just appear, right? So conveniently appear, just like you pointed out with the zip file of the photos, suddenly leftist groups have this. Where do they get it? Well, we don't know, but they just got it. Suddenly they've got it. Oh, here it is. We've got it. We've got the details.
We got the proof.
And in this case, what we've seen many times in the past, and in fact, oddly enough, I was commenting on different shows the past couple weeks that I would be suspicious. I said to Patrick on his show, I would be suspicious of a virtual Elohim City type situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
And this, I think, is leading towards being that kind of a scenario. And so conservatives, veterans, racists, it all has the catch-all to sort of group everyone that might be considered an enemy of the state, so
right.
to speak. And just like the Elliot Rogers incident, which had all these same scenarios, Rogers, in that case, it was masculinity. Men are bad because this guy, couldn't get sex, so he had to shoot everybody. And in this case, we've seen some of that too. This is a loner, although the testimony of his friends did not seem to support that. Many of his friends, including black friends with Ruth, seemed to say that he didn't seem to be so radical and racist and insane.
That's right. Yeah.
Then the ready-made gun legislation comes to the fore. Obama's immediately on the scene, talking about the tragedy, talking about gun control. Hillary comes out saying we need to disarm. Immediately the media says disarm white men, as if white men are the only people who commit murders, when in fact black on white murders are something like 5 times higher. Some, I don't even remember the exact statistic, but it's
shh. You can't talk about that. Can't talk about that.
No, you can't, even though it's like it's FBI statistics. We'll even talk about this, but the shooters are conspicuously killed, suicided, spirited away, lost, unknown. We don't get any details about them. And in this case, the individual is, of course, in custody. But I would suspect, like with James Holmes, we will not know much more about what's going on with him unless they choose to air some more curious, unprecedented bail hearings, which I never see bail hearings aired on national television, but in this case, it was very much an emotional, heartstring pulling, tugging psyop, I would say, to,
yes,
to have, the people saying how much they love him and forgive him and crying on camera. And certainly, I would agree that, you know, if this went down as we are told it went down, it was definitely a tragedy. But tragedy nonetheless, we cannot be foolish and overlook the possibility of more to the story. So I say then, one of my last features of what would be questionable is that the mainstream media will reveal, in a bizarre use of Twilight language, some sort of double meanings, innuendos, or references that often come up in, say, pop culture. And in this case, I this is not, again, any definite proof, but it usually connects in these kinds of questionable scenarios. I wrote an analysis of the Kingsman Secret Service a few months ago. And in that film, the mind-controlled MI6 agent is taken over by the black character, and he goes into a Southern church and shoots it up during the church service. And so numerous people are dead, and Colin Firth is the character playing the British spy, comes out, and he comes out of his mind control state being basically hypnotized through Samuel L. Jackson as the villain character, through his technology, mind control technology that he's used. And so he's basically just been framed for a mass church shooting. So The Kingsman came out, of course, earlier this year, a few months ago. And I believe in my analysis, I even hinted at the fact that we might possibly see something along these lines in the near future. So, again, that's not any kind of definite proof, but I think it's curious. It's very odd that, you know, this major film release had a church shooting with a black guy running, a white guy doing it. That does not mean that I know that some black guy was the handler of Dylann Roof. I'm just saying it's a curious connection.
Yeah.
So from there, you know, we look at these photos, and then I think we should consider the prevalence of the crisis actor phenomenon. So although this has been, I think, a little bit exaggerated by alternative media, where everybody's seeing actors everywhere, that's not the case. However, there is some truth in this, where there are large-scale groups of actors that are hired for military work. Many of them are former military, and so therefore they are, of course, sworn to silence, or they're part of, they're basically, when you join the military, you're owned by the government. So, I mean, from there on, you're limited in what you can do and even talk about, even when you leave the service. And so, again, that I think is suspicious, just because of the ability that the state has there for, basically controlling lives and controlling information. And so this crisis actor phenomenon is very real. And in fact, you can look up, I believe it was one of the former high ups in the CIA actually owns a company which is involved in crisis scenarios, crisis management, and they have a large retinue of, I guess, out of work actors who participate in these things. So now that does not mean that there can't be also, you know, a black ops hit team that comes in at the same time and actually does kill people. So all of these scenarios are possible and need to be considered. And we don't need to just immediately adopt either the mainstream media or the presentation in, say, majority alternative media. And so I see it again. It's very much in the same vein as Sandy Hook, which there's a lot of questionable aspects to Sandy Hook that are very similar to this case with Adam Lanza, although the unique aspect here is, of course, the racial element. And I think that the behavior of some of the people in the Charleston shooting situation are curious as well. They don't seem to act like persons that, you know, a day prior saw the death of their mother. And, of course, we have to always keep in mind the number one key factor to always consider in these cases, and that is the drill. And sure enough, in this case, we have the drill running concurrently with the National Guard, and I believe what Homeland Security, Operation Vigilant Guard, will be running mass shooter, in fact, drills in this area during the very time that this supposedly goes down. So those are my initial thoughts on this. And in one concluding point, I would say I've seen one mainstream source. This was the Atlantic from the left making a connection. So it was actually one of the first things I thought of was the church burning phenomena of the 90s. And I remember being in high school in the 90s and seeing on CNN, you know, all of these Southern black churches were just, there's just this, ravaging attacks of epidemic of church burnings across the South. Well, it turns out that was actually not true. And there is a Wall Street Journal reporter back in 1996 and 97 named Michael Fumento did two interesting reports exposing how those were completely made up. There was no rash of racist church burnings in the South. And in fact, while there might have been a few of those, eight of them out of the 20 or 27, excuse me, in 1 year were actually done by blacks.
Really?
Yes. And so this can be found in Michael Fumo's two reports, Who's Fanning the Flames of Racism and A Church Arson Epidemic, It's Smoke and Mirrors. And so, again, these are, of course, put in mainstream media in the Wall Street Journal. So these are not conspiracy websites.
Interesting. Yeah. Did not know that.
Yeah, this was a big deal back in the 90s in the U.S. And so Charleston was one of the locations where this was happening quite often.
Right.
And so it was, again, a clear frame-up job where the media just invented this scenario. And so whenever there was a church burning or even, say, a church caught on fire just from bad electrical work or whatever, the media was just saying it was a racially motivated, it was a complete fiction. And so the Atlantic, in their piece on the Dylann Roof shooting, pointed out how, well, this is just a culmination of the church burnings of the 90s.
Interesting.
Well, and go ahead.
No, I just want to mention as well, do you remember, was it earlier this year, back in January, early January, there was another bombing at the NAACP in, I think it was in Colorado Springs.
And that was completely staged as well.
Same thing. Yeah. They even saw it on Google Earth of all places, or the Street View, Google Street View, that the same soot marks, I guess, along the building was there. I don't know how many, a couple of months before, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. Interesting. So we got to take that into account here, into consideration. Now, but how does that differ, do you think? Let's say between that and I don't know if there were people die, if people allegedly died in those church burnings as well, or were there victims in those? Do you know?
In most of these cases, no. In the 90s, there were not actual deaths. I think in one of these, there's two articles he did, and one of them he lists all the stats. In South Carolina, there were 27 in the 90s. The stats, according to the government, were that 27 of the fires were probably not arson. So there were 27 fires just in South Carolina, and let's see, if the total number was something like 90. And they said that 27 of these 90 were not arson. So of the 27 in South Carolina, the media just basically created the narrative of this being racial when it was not. Now, there may have been one or two that were, because, you know, not all of these are solved. So who knows?
And then you get copycat things on top of it as well.
And he mentions the copycat situation as well.
Yeah.
But he does point out that far from all the arsonists having been white, 8 of the 18 arrested in South Carolina were black.
Interesting.
So, you know, there's multiple factors that could motivate someone to do church burning, as you pointed out. But nevertheless, there's no question when we think of the Trayvon situation and the altering of the color of Zimmerman's skin and the editing of the 911 call by Zimmerman. When we look at Ferguson, Michael Brown, all of these are clear chosen stories, because there are murders happening quite consistently.
Yes.
Especially in places like Chicago. And in fact, as I pointed out in my piece, there were two church shootings within this last week, or the last 7 days, I should say, that were not reported. And one of them was a black man shooting up churchgoers at a black church, I believe. And another one was a black man shooting whites for explicitly racial reasons, all of which completely ignored.
That's right. Yeah. And these happen all the time. And for some reason, there's only certain stories that are, they get this kind of just,
yes,
they just roll out on the mainstream and they go for days, weeks, months in some cases, and repeat it. Let's get in and talk a little bit more about, you know, I guess the bigger picture, a little bit of that a little bit later. But I wanted to ask if there's anything else. I mean, as usual, we don't have, and you clarified this, we don't have enough information. But let's give the media a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, I guess, that they somehow run with information as it comes into them. But we've noticed a couple of things immediately that, and as usual, the media is very sloppy because they want to be first with the story. And it seems like even some of the kids that were interviewed, some of the friends of Dylan, they kind of milked out certain statements from them and then they ran with it. There's even, you know, testimony, we've gone through some of the transcripts of the interviews where they say that their words were twisted and many of them were not happy with how it came out at the end. So I wonder how much of that they kind of milk out of the situation and then decide to run with it themselves, effectively creating this as they go.
I think it's also worth mentioning, I agree, that this comes on the heels of the trial of James Holmes. So this is also in the news at the moment, where the defense is preparing their case for the Aurora shooter. And so, boom, right on the end of the storyline of Holmes, who, again, is also in the mainstream media at this point, now there's a new one. And I should add as well that it was maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, that the mainstream media had resurrected Holmes with finding his manifesto. Apparently, he had written a diary that suddenly appeared conveniently right before his trial was coming to a close. And so the media was able to run a story of his manifesto. So, yes, I think that James Holmes, in that scenario of, you know, the instances of mention of mind control, he was working for DARPA programs with the Brain Initiative, the Salk Institute. And so if we want to look at the larger context, I think that we step one level up and we see the summer of rage, the summer of race war, explicitly promoted, mentioned by the left in the mainstream media. And this is, we think of Soros funding the situation of Ferguson in Baltimore, $33 million, as the media has reported.
That's a lot.
It is. And in fact, as I understand from some reliable sources that I have, this is actually, these protesters are actually kind of bussed around. So
they
put them up in hotels for being protesters. And then you come out and you do your little media shtick and try to provocateur. And then you go back to your hotel and then they bust you to the next one. Which is supposedly a lot better provocateur lifestyle than back in, say, the 60s or something.
Exactly.
I guess you kind of had to live in a tent or something if you were working for leftist think tanks or something. But certainly at this level, we're looking at, I think, an internal strategy of tension that is being pushed by the Obama administration, the Department of Justice, by the think tanks that have a more leftist bent, that work in concert with them, that would like very much to see racial tension, racial war. I think all you have to do is look at the foreign policy, the strategy of the think tanks in terms of Ukraine and these other color revolutions. And that's exactly what's going on in the U.S. And in fact, I heard an interview with an author who'd written a book on false flags today. He said the exact same thing. He said, to me, it just looks like the color revolution strategy in the U.S. And I think at this point, it's pertinent to remember Gene Sharp, the professor who works with Ford Foundation, Einstein Institute. He's the head guy, whatever the Einstein Institute is. And he's the professor known for writing the book on how to create, quote, democratic revolutions. And he's been called out for getting CIA funding and aid. And he, of course, goes nuts when he gets called out on this. But there's no question in my mind that this is exactly what's going on. It's all the same strategy, the old technique of using demagogues, using the left, using populism or appeals to populism under the banner of manufactured oppression, right? And it's the same with Femin. It's the same with the women's rights organizations. All of these groups have all the same funding from the Fortune 100.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. There's so many different underlying factors to why we should be suspicious. And again, I'm not one who jump immediately that we have to wait for more information, but at the same time that we can't trust information that we're getting either. I don't know how many things I've read now about, an investigator say, that he knew what he was doing, or someone told us that yes, it was solely racially motivated, etc. So much hearsay, and even the witness, or I shouldn't say witnesses, but people who were closely relatives to those who went through this, those who survived, they say one thing, and then it's picked up by the media, and so it's very difficult to know exactly what the truth is and what actually was said. Now, the manifesto itself, though, obviously that's what people link and say, well, that is the proof of what was what the motivations were. Did you look more detail on the manifesto? What's your thoughts on that?
I did, and I think it's curious that his blog appears to be fairly recent. And it's also curious that the domain appears to be registered in Russia.
Yeah, through Russian registrar,
Which could suggest many different things. I'm not saying that I think that means that Russians were running this. What it could suggest is whoever, if this was an operation, whoever was behind it would, of course, register it in a foreign situation to complicate tracking.
Yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily finger any specific group or entity per se. But I think that it's curious that when Obama came out to discuss this, one of the things he said in one of the interviews was that we are still not yet cured of racism. Now, cure suggests that there is an affliction deep within us, psychologically, perhaps even in our very being, as perhaps being of a different race. And so this requires medical attention. Cures presupposes medicine. And so I would completely agree with many of the Sandy Hook researchers who posit that the purpose of Sandy Hook and Adam Lanza was to move things towards the mindset that medical and psychological testing needs to be done on a much larger scale. And so the medical arm of the establishment, I think, is very much tyrannical, very much tied up in all these same global cartels, all the same oligarchs, and they would love to have the gun rights be completely restricted, taken away. And the best way to do that would be through the legality of requiring some sort of psychological profiling for everybody, ultimately, which would, of course, be to target anyone who had dissent against the state. I mean, this is just the Soviet model of calling everyone mentally ill who didn't believe in the Soviet party line.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's, I guess, somewhat controversial, but I think it's absolutely correct. That's exactly what every one of them comes out, all the left comes out on the media and says.
But it seems to be a conflict within what, I mean, I'm not saying that the, okay, let me rephrase that. When you look at it at face value, it does seem to suggest that they're all on the same page because they hammer the same message. But at the same time, some people say, you know, well, no, don't call him mentally ill because he knows exactly what he's doing. Because he's a racist, but that in itself, just as you say, is a mental illness, and that we can cure with various things and meds and whatnot. But they're also talking about legislating against so-called white supremacy and
exactly it has all of these it's tailor-made. It has all of these uses. So that would include speech on the internet. It would include as well as speech in public, right? It's not accidental that this is global, and you see the same restrictions going in with the EU and their cramp down on free speech and calling everything hate, everything racism, anything related to questions of local culture, local stability, tradition, history, etc. These are gradually pretty quickly being labeled as just an irrational sense hate. And that's absolutely by design. And so it fits perfectly with, as you pointed out to me a while back, the point of the former World Bank head NATO person, Peter Sutherland, saying that any idea of homogeneity has to be absolutely erased. And this is the goal of the EU.
Exactly.
And it's no different in the U.S. This is what's crucial to see. It's the exact same strategy in the U.S. And that's just like the EU is a trade, supposed to be this economic union. Right now, today, they're discussing, and it was Senator Sessions was giving his talk on the congressional floor today about the fact that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, these trade deals, Obama trade, this is nothing but the exact same plan of the Continental Trading Bloc of the EU. And this absolutely confirms everything that we in the so-called conspiracy realm have been saying for years. Here it is. Here's the legislation. It's actually being discussed. They want to pass the Continental Trading Bloc, which is the 100-year-old, 200-year-old oligarch plan.
Exactly. Now, I think in the States, in certain regards, it's a bit harsher on certain things, at least when it comes to things like white privilege. I mean, they're ramping up that dialogue in Europe now, too, certainly. But it might seem... It's a little bit different over there to a certain extent, but I've seen just an explosion, obviously, then in the last couple of days.
Yeah, we're
of attacks, on white Americans. Basically, they are the target. That's the. I mean, we had Al Qaeda, we had ISIS, extreme, Islamic, terrorism, etc. But now it's the white guy that's the threat,
Mm-hmm. And they're as we know, in alternative media, this has been. The plan all along was to eventually flip the script over from the radical Islamist to the so-called white terrorist. And so here they are appearing just perfectly on time as we need them. But I think that the U.S. is fortunately not as far down the road, as I understand from people that I talk to in other countries, as the EU in terms of limiting of speech, limiting of freedom of thought, expression and so forth. So I would agree with, for example, your interview with Mark Hackard, where he was critical of philosophical liberalism, and that is the ideological foundation of the United States. However, I would also, I'm glad that we are at least not as far down the road as some of the EU states, where you can go to prison for what you say. So you may, as we talked about last time, you may lose your job or something like that. But fortunately, at this point, you're not yet going to go to jail in the U.S. Unless you perhaps live in California or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, given time, they'll get to that.
It will. Yeah, it will. Yeah.
I think it was his former stepmom, Paige Mann, I think was her name. She was talking about how, he was locked in his room looking up bad stuff on his computer. She said,
and the bad stuff was defined as alternative media sources.
Exactly. He said something on the computer drew him in this "This is evil internet," she said Saturday from her home. So, you know, give him time. But there's a lot of things they seem to want to push into this. As we say, we have the gun issue. We have the issue of course, critique, I guess, from more and more people of European descent around in specifically also in European countries, but also in America now, of course, of, you know, population displacement and some of these other programs that have been running for a while now. And we see a clear attack on, as you said, Southern symbolism, like the Confederate flag. It's now going to be taken away from basically all the major, you know, from Walmart to Amazon and all that stuff. So it's a they're seeking to squeeze a hell of a lot into this. And the question is, do you think, are they moving a little bit too quick, too fast here? Or
I think so. I think the reaction is going to be larger and larger because they waste no time in charging forward. I mean, this is basically just the racial version of Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing and, you know, James Holmes. This is just the same thing, but racial. And not everybody is stupid. We're not all dumb. We're not all zombies. So there are plenty of people in the South that live in this. I live in the South who know the history of the Confederacy and they know about the South. And the narrative that almost the entire country, especially the North, has about the Civil War is 99.9% inaccurate, not true. It's made up. You know, history is written by the victors. So for most of the South, you know, who has somewhat of an education, you know, we actually know what happened in the Civil War. And it's not anything simplistic that you can boil down to you know, good guy, bad guy. But of course, that's the modern dumbed down dialectic thinks in that way. Good guy, bad guy. So, you know, the Civil War, as we know, I'm sure you know, was not primarily about slavery. It was about tariffs. It was about manifest destiny, expansion, yep. Things like that.
That's
it was
right.
About states' rights. It was about Southern economy. So when you consider the fact that many of the blacks that were freed actually had to go into worse living conditions by working in the industrial North in a wage slave situation that was worse off.
Yeah, that's true.
And blacks don't tend to know this.
They actually showed, just let me interject that, they actually showed that pretty well in the North and South, by the way, pretty good. They showed the different, the treatments of, you know, yeah, wage slaves were, you know, versus the other scenario. And it's, yeah, it's true.
I believe it's, as I understand, it's correct that 2% of the South owned slaves, which is a very small portion. Most of the slave, or most of the whites in the South, were poor, basically indentured servants. They were not Colonel Sanders sipping mint juleps on a on the porch of a you know, a state.
Yeah, cracking the whip and just
cracking the whip,
get on, boy. Yeah,
like Django. No, it was not like that at all.
No.
And there's plenty of even, you know, literary sources. We read Mark Twain that give a picture of the South that is not at all like what we see in modern day fictional narratives. So, you know, there's just so much propaganda and nonsense about all that. And at the same time, I don't mean to make the South out to be some sort of saintly haven. I would agree with say Flannery O'Connor's picture of the South, that it's sort of haunted by the ghost of Jesus.
So, right.
So it's more of a, you know, Southern Gothic type situation where there's this air image of religion, but it's also very primal and it's also very, and there's pros and cons to that. You know, I mean,
yeah,
I can go down the road and there's Mennonites that are selling food that isn't tainted with, you know, GMO and processed ingredients. So that's a very old school good thing that the South still has, but of course they would like to get rid of all that eventually. So I, you know, I don't mean to delve into necessarily a big history lesson, but you know, it's important to remember that slavery was not the idea or invention of Southern whites in the U.S. As you well know, there were black slave traders that enslaved other blacks. There were Hispanic, Jewish, Asian, basically all Arabs. Arabs were very cruel to blacks in the Arab slave trade. So the slave trade is pretty much a feature of all cultures in the last, several millennia. So I find it very odd that suddenly the only people that are expected to make reparations for things in the past are whites living in today that do not have a connection to the slave trade. And no one ever talks about white slavery in terms of sex slaves.
Yeah.
Yet, that's something that goes on quite frequently.
It's so myopic, Jay, because it's like this, it's the only issue. Like there's some kind of, I guess the problematic part here is when, I don't say that, likely as a way to kind of brush it off, but when victimhood becomes kind of part of identity, I think it's a shame. I think it takes things in a wrong direction, and also that it's somehow kind of they have monopoly on being victimized historically, which is just yes. Untrue,
And it gives people a means to live, right? Because they're angry, they have an enemy,
yeah,
and they have a will to defeat someone, and it doesn't even matter how real that narrative is. It's a ideology, a worldview that they've adopted that allows them to have meaning, I guess, right? You have a bad guy now, so you have somebody to oppose and somebody who's oppressed you. And when in fact, in my situation, the jobs I've had in the past, I've seen people of minority situations promoted more often than I've been, right? And I don't think that I was the worst worker in the various corporate settings I was in. But I think that affirmative action is something that pretty clearly shows that you're actually given quite a bit of upper hand as a minority than every other white person. Now, granted, certainly there are differences, Dixie Mafia or the WASP Mafia, New England. And obviously there are, elite conclaves. I'm not denying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
yeah.
To just have this mindless collective guilt is utterly ridiculous. And as you've pointed out, this collective guilt is actually a warfare strategy. So we're living in the midst of just huge, large scale psychological warfare strategies that are intended on, basically eradicating any kind of living or way of living prior to 1950 or so.
Well, exactly. Let me just pick up on that a little bit, because I think it's the question is, where does it end? Because right now we're seeing in America, we're seeing, the Confederate flag that's going to go before Obama comes to visit to give the talk there for Reverend Pinckney in Charleston a week or 2 weeks or something. Who knows? By that time, the flag might be taken down from Columbia, the capital there. We'll have to see. But okay, it begins with that, right? But now they're moving, removing Andrew Jackson from the $20 bill. Their statues are being demolished. Schools are being renamed. It's about tearing down any kind of symbol, primarily of old white guys, but it's also this idea that that somehow the past was a vicious, cruel era, and now we're in this new, beautiful world, and therefore these symbols will have to go in for the sake of inclusiveness. But the question is, where does it end? Because certainly the United States flag, that's also ultimately a symbol of repression and slavery, right? So that needs to go next.
I'd like to add just one little tidbit, which is somewhat ironic too. As I understand, the history of the Confederate flag is the old British naval flag. Had connections, of course, to the British and Dutch East India Company. So that's just a little bit of irony there. But are we going to see the call for the removal of the ANC, African National Congress flag? I don't think so, right?
And no.
They're busy killing whites. Where's the outrage over this? There's not any.
Nothing.
What about... there's just so many ways you could take this. I'm not far from the Hermitage, which is Andrew Jackson's, famous for Andrew Jackson's being his, I guess at one time he lived in the Hermitage. He lived in different places, but the Hermitage is not far from here. I guess it'll have to all be torn down, right? Or we'll have to convert that into some sort of UN Martin Luther King site. Everything will have, I mean, how far does it go? Does everything exactly have to be replaced? There's just no coherency to this. And this is the danger of mob mentality. In fact, I, as my own little sort of test, I commented on some large leftist sites on Facebook. I left some comments that were discussing the Confederate flag issue. And I was pointing out that you might be surprised to know, many of you on here, that this is actually a Democratic flag. Many, because you have the phenomenon in the South of what's called the Dixiecrat. And this is the old Democratic Party affiliation with the Ku Klux Klan and the Confederacy, which most people in the North don't know about that. But and it was literally, I had hundreds of them frothing and ready to kill me. And they were they were going crazy. Just F this, F you this, go kill yourself, you're a piece of, you know,
yeah,
bleep. And so the mindlessness of this is what's so insane. I mean, these people have absolutely no conception of anything about history at all. No idea what's actually going on. And that's the danger, is that these are the people that are going to be mobilized by the state, by our corporate state, to target all of us, you know, as domestic terrorists.
Exactly. And that's, yeah, we, you know, we'll have to fight against that, because that's no good. And the question is, of course, how, you know, they will start here and then they will come after other people. And, but there's a, it's like a minimization. It's, I compared it. There was another symbol where on flags, the Swedish flag was denied to be flown or waved at a graduation, not party. A graduation in Sweden a while back here. And they decided to not show any flags because it was, you know, that was, they could be seen as offensive, and they even stopped to sing the national anthem and things like this. And the thing that came to me, it was that it's kind of reminiscent of the Reformation, that when we went through that up in the North, it was very fairly bloodless, actually, but it was, you know, removing all the idols, you know, all the things that could mean something symbolically of the saints and things like that. And it became eventually just a Lutheran practice of having a you know, a black cross on a white wall, and that's it. It's like a minimization issue. And that's, to a certain extent, it's like the continuation of that we're removing so much, anything that can mean something whatsoever. No colors, no combination of letters, because ultimately someone could be offended by this at some stage. And if that's the mentality we're going to peddle to, then we're not going to have anything left at the end of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to show an illustration of how ridiculous it is, if we look at black activists 100 years ago, they would be called flaming wicked racists by today's standards. And I use as my example for this, black activist W.E.B. Du Bois has a lecture from September 1903 called The Talented Tenth, where he discusses how the only way possible for the raising of the black race would be for the best amongst the black race to raise everyone else up. And if you read this essay, I mean, it would just, if I were to post this essay as a white person, it would be viewed as, you know, I would be lynched, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And the irony here is that, of course, this is actually a black activist from 100 years ago. So yeah, that's how crazy things have gotten in the last 100 years. And it's just accelerating at such a rapid pace, as you pointed out. But I would encourage readers to read The Talented Tenth by W.E.B. Du Bois. This is a famous historical essay, and this will give you a picture of, from a black perspective, of how things were 100 years ago. And I would argue that we're actually in a much worse state, because, you know, people would like to say that, well, you know, we've had so much progress and things are so much better, you know, after all these civil rights legislations and so forth and so on. I don't think so. I think things are getting worse, and I think they're getting worse by design. And I just keep coming back to Brave New World in the last week or so, because I've been rereading it. And in Brave New World, everything is completely managed. and that's where we're going. It's a medical tyranny that constitutes Brave New World. And you don't have any freedom as to, you know, what you can say or think, except sexual liberty, right? So this is promoted. They would, in fact, like to have racial mixing of all kinds, because I've even seen quotes from UN leaders that what we need is actually a massive brown race in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No distinction. So the irony here is that the so-called leftist toleration actually becomes an enforced tyranny that requires the destruction of existing people groups. And that is a strategy of warfare.
Absolutely. Yep. Now, how do you begin to legislate against hate and prejudice? I mean, these are the things, some of the ideas that have been discussed, and I've been viewing quite a bit of MSNBC and CNN and ABC News footage, and some of the things that is discussed in the wake of this, and just beyond, you know, we need to disarm all white people kind of sentiments. It's been many propositions of legislation that needs to come into place. What do you think? I mean, what do you think their move is going to be if they go into legislation wise?
Probably we will see in the next 10 years where we'll be in the situation of the EU, because the legislation with the Transatlantic Partnership, Trans-Pacific Partnership, blah, 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 all these TTP stuff, all of this is, you know, we only have a few inklings of what the clauses are in this thing. And the whispers are, of course, that the other clauses deal with complete restrictions of guns, of speech. And so the speech will be completely regulated. And that's exactly where we're going. So I would say, like I said, the next 10 years, the U.S. will be where the EU is. And California is always a good test case for the U.S. because I lived in California as a child. And so when I was there, my dad was in the Navy. So I was in the sort of advanced new agey test schooling that they had out there, and we were getting all of the green stuff back in 1984 and 85 when I was a kid, and then that all of that green then filtered into the rest of the U.S. about 20 years later in terms of not just the educational pedagogy, but the beginning of the attempts to inflict emissions legislation that your cars, for example, in North Carolina, you have to pay these fines every few months for driving a car. This is completely ridiculous. So this is just one example of how that green agenda is beginning to be enforced in other places that was tested out. Kind of looking at, California is a big test tube. It's also a military industrial complex state, very big time.
Yeah.
And so there's a intimate connection there between those two, right? So we can't think of the U.S. and the military as somehow like this oppositional entity to the UN or the EU. They're not. They're all in accord with the same oligarchic structure above them. So that's where we're going. We're going towards, you know, total. Was it Sweden? I believe it was Sweden just passed. They have, don't they have the legislation about entering restrooms if you identify as a different gender?
Yeah, was it Sweden? Maybe it was.
Or one of the Nordic countries.
Yeah, for sure.
Legislation, and that's being discussed here in the U.S. as well, in different, I guess what we might call progressive, quote-unquote, enclaves. And that's at least one positive aspect of the U.S. is that there are still areas where there's kind of enclaves where it's not... It's not as bad.
And that's the problem, right? Because that's why they were grouping so many different issues into this particular one. I mean, the first, I saw a couple of articles coming out and they talked about, you know, basically associating the father of Dylann Roof with like, look at this. He had a don't tread on me flag. And then it's like, it's anti-government people, patriots, pro-America. Then you have, you know, white nationalists. You have so-called white supremacists, neo-Nazis, the whole gambit, the whole range of things needs to be, you know, balled into this thing and then associated with what has happened here, basically.
Oh, they hate the South. I can't tell you how much they hate the South. And in fact, this is the ultimate telling hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Is that I've grown up quite a bit of my life in the South in a small town, and we are actually a retirement area. And who do you think comes to our area to retire, to get away from the hectic life of the city?
Northerners?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they create complete hell holes, and most of them come from Chicago, and they move here. There are plenty of people in the North that are cool, that are really, really neat, smart people. But so many of them that move here into this area, and I've seen it for years, immediately hate everyone in the South. They're just completely hateful, still bitter, you know, over thinking that we're all stupid here in the South and we're all inbred, and we don't know anything about anything. Yet they want to come here because we don't have crazy crime rates.
Yeah, we have low taxes. Tax leniency, yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So
so they love, so they love
they
it.
They create hell holes and then they want them here, yeah. And because we aren't as screwed up as they are.
And then they come there and then they lobby for, you know, diversity, exactly. And more, you know, stronger unions and higher taxes. And
complete state control, and that's what, yeah. They come here and they bring their destruction with them.
Yeah. Oh boy. Well, I mean, I thought diversity then would be the solution to this, that, you know, you can have many different types of societies with many different cultural backgrounds, associations, groupings, interests, what have you. But it's just as you said before, it seems to be the opposite. It's the exclusion of it. It's the destruction of these that diversity is the primary.
Yes, diversity is the means to destroy diversity.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's truly incredible. What do you think the response, if we're still on that for a little bit here, the South, the response will be from Southerners now when the Confederate flag, most likely it's just going to be removed altogether. At least they've said, okay, well, you can still have it on your private property. Oh, yay, great. And that might be for a little while, but eventually that will probably be attacked also. But now, do you think there's going to be a stronger reaction against this, and this is even more going to drive them away from the rest of America? What do you think?
Well, if you've ever been to Kentucky or Tennessee, or surrounding states, there are Confederate monuments everywhere. So this is a bit ridiculous. I mean, this is a bit over the top. There's no way that they're going to remove every Confederate monument. Now, so what's in the news is the discussion of removing Confederate flags from certain cities. I'm sure that will be done, and there will probably be certain areas where Confederate stuff might be taken down, but that's just so unfeasible in Kentucky or Tennessee because it's everywhere. I mean, I can go, you can't go 10 minutes in any direction without reaching some sort of state landmark that is a Confederate battleground, Confederate monument, park, Civil War memorial. I mean, they're everywhere, literally. So there's no way that's going to happen anytime soon. Now, I'm sure that many groups would like that. But just as in the situations of the 90s church burnings, there were calls for the Confederate flag to be banned. And a few years ago, there was some stir in the news because some student in high school wore a Confederate shirt to his high school. And there was calls for the banning of all this. And that's not going to happen. I mean, I can drive down the road 20 minutes and I'll probably see 10 Confederate flags hanging up.
Yeah, exactly. We saw some of the monuments, by the way. There was a couple in Charleston, obviously. Orangeburg and a couple of places spray painted and stuff like that.
Right. And I expect to see more of that.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
But again, there's just so many. I mean,
they can't go after it all.
Well,
they can.
It's just completely unfeasible. It's just like gun control. I mean, there's so many gun owners that while they want to have gun control and they keep trying to push it and push it and push it, I mean, all it does is backfire and people go and buy more guns.
Buy more guns, exactly.
And again, there's so many gun owners in the U.S. It's unreal. Everybody I know owns guns. I mean, I don't know anybody that doesn't have a gun.
Good.
At least locally, personally.
Yeah.
So it's just completely unfeasible to think that passing legislation or even running these big psyops, as they are in my opinion, is going to eventually get rid of guns. So there's a little bit of fear campaign involved in that too, But all that fear does is just cause people to buy more. So it's really, I think you have a lot of decadent elites at, say, the you know, maybe the Bloomberg level that live, you know, they're so used to a cosmopolitan lifestyle and living in the city. And of course they have bodyguards with their
arms. Oh, of course. Exactly.
But they're so out of touch, I think, with how everybody else lives. In a lot of conservative commentators have pointed this out, and I think it's true. You know, when you get into areas like California or New York, they just have this insanely arrogant assumption that everybody in the Midwest or in the South are just completely stupid and we're barbaric, and, you know, all we do is have sex with our sisters and you know, shoot each other all the time. I mean, that's just completely not true. In fact, you know, some of the most intelligent, best writers from the U.S. are Southern. You know, Mark Twain, Flannery O'Connor, William Faulkner. I mean, we're not stupid.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's just this mass ignorance that exists. And I just liken it to, you know, Mark Dice's videos. People think those are staged. I'm telling you, they're not. They're not staged. If you've been to the North, if you've been to, I've lived in California, that's how people actually are. They really do just have this completely, you know, delusional worldview.
Well, exactly. I mean, I agree. I think the libtards are so disconnected from reality, and they think they have everything under wraps. And I think what bothers me the most is that there seems to be a lot of people that are antithetical for what they stand for that still seem to, though, you know, bow down to the moral indictments that they send against some people. And that's kind of frustrating too, because to a certain extent it's working, right? To a certain extent. Okay, there is a reaction to it. We've kind of talked about that. But at the same time, the dialogue, the cultural dialogue in the media and things like now with the Confederate flag. I mean, although there's a resistance, they are gaining ground all the time, correct?
They are. So I think they've ramped it up, especially in the last few years, big time. But I think there will be a backlash. People are gradually waking up in the U.S. I don't know how successful that's going to be. They're not waking up fast enough. And as you said, yes, they are gaining ground. In my opinion, which Huxley also discusses in Brave New World, is that the real goal is not you or me or baby boomers. It's the youth. And that's who they really, really, really want to go after. And they've said that the globalists have said this many times in their writings, that, you know, all you have to do is get the youth. So a lot of this, I think, is targeted towards millennials and younger. And so they're really the target of the heaviest brainwashing. So that's the real danger here, is they think long term, and they're thinking, if we can capture those younger generations, they'll completely be on board. They're the ones that'll turn on their parents and, you know, rat on them for hate speech or whatever to the coming technocratic authorities. So that's the danger.
Right. Yeah, to kind of circumvent wholesome parenting, to circumvent reason and logic along the way, and just go straight to them and kind of make them accustomed to the new way of life, and then when the older generations die, that's it. We've transformed society overnight, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they don't have a problem thinking 10, 20, 50 years down the road.
Oh, certainly not.
No. You know that, but a lot of people get caught up in the immediacy of this or that spectacle or this or that event, and certainly we have to look at the immediacy and consider the legislation and all that. But I mean, you know, look at this, you know, Trans-Pacific trade deal. This has been long in the works. I mean, they've been working towards this for decades. So, and it's not any different with education. And so that's what a Common Core, that's what sensitivity training in the corporate sphere, diversity training, it's all scientifically engineered to, you know, to take things in that direction.
Yeah, exactly. I think there was under TPP, there was an immigration clause that was quite extensive as well, and the United States could find itself back to like 1920s type of lifting, or when there was no restrictions on immigration and stuff like that.
Yeah, so and that was also not a good thing. There was a reason why they put limitations on.
Of course, exactly.
On that. So, yeah, that's what they. When you have these mindless millennials and these brainwashed younger groups, you know, they have no conception of the real world and how things work, and so they want, you know, they think, oh, we can house the whole world. We can just have millions more immigrants come. And they don't realize that this is the complete destruction of their culture, because their culture's actually already been destroyed. Right. So everyone lives on Facebook and their iPads. So there's not a culture. And so, unfortunately the destruction is pretty much complete in terms of the minds of the youth, I would say. But I think it'll be a good several years before all the Confederate monuments are taken down.
Yeah, I think so too. But that speaks a little bit to something which could indicate, of course, the sincerity, the authenticity of the suspect that we're talking about here too. That I mean, who knows, right? There might be an aspect here to where he was on drugs, he was living a kind of very sad life to a certain extent, kind of miserable and nothing there. And then who knows again what he learned along the way and whatever. But of course, the actions doesn't make sense with that. There's a disconnection there of he mentioned certain things in his manifesto, and then you know, how you can go from one thing to another, and then all of a sudden, you know, kill 9 innocent people in a church of all places. It's kind of like Breivik too, that, you know, what the things he said and stuff like that. And then he goes after, you know, primarily I think primarily Norwegian, you know, young kids as well. It's like, well, what is this? You know, but I don't mean to downplay what has happened here and all that, but if you take the position for a moment that this is managed in some way, this kind of an entrapment program that right. Dylan was, he was managed in some way. There seems to be, by the way, particularly among, you know, FBI and other intelligence services, a tendency for them to actually get involved in, you know, white supremacy groups and even run them in some cases. There's plenty of that in the past, right? So we
like
really,
it's a virtual Elohim City. Yes,
exactly. And that was even
Elohim City, right?
Yeah. And there was even a connection to SPLC about that. I think Morris Deese was involved in some way. He said that if I tell you what we actually were involved in there or whatever, I would have to kill you or something. It was a weird quote he mentioned to the media at some point. And of course, SPLC and Morris Deese are those who are first to jump on the bandwagon that all this hate is real, because we can not only make money on it, we can push society in a certain political direction while doing that as well. So they're gaining a lot from, you know, basically I'm saying, if there isn't hate out there, then they will invent it and run with it so that they can prove that it exists in the world, right?
Two things it reminds me of is Poplawski, who there's questionable aspects of the Poplawski event when he shot police as a white supremacist, supposedly, when actually he was just mentally unstable.
Right.
It reminds me also of, as you mentioned, Breivik. I mean, there's not a logic to what they're doing. And so we have to wonder, again, of the possibility of entrapment. I think you're absolutely spot on there, and especially since the New York Times has run major pieces, as I mentioned in our Hebdo interview, the famous front page piece a couple of years ago about how most bomb plots are hatched by the FBI.
Yeah, that's right.
We can't overlook that. So that doesn't just extend to Al-Qaeda bomb plots. As I said in a recent interview with Patrick on 21st Century Wire, this extends to any sort of radical group. We mentioned we were going to talk about the Garland shooting. There's another one that no one has seemed to speak about that I think's worth looking at, and that's Inna Shevchenko, who's the femin chick, who's this Ukrainian girl who was recruited into femin to promote the radical feminist movement and sort of the Pussy Riot type stuff. And she was involved in the Copenhagen shooting by the supposed radical Islamists. And again, I'm not saying there aren't radical Islamic groups and that there aren't mass Islamic immigration. That's a problem. There is. But we also have to understand the strategy of tension here. And so when I think about Garland and the shooting event involving Pamela Geller, I'm reminded of Inna Shevchenko's shooting event where she emerges as the hero of free speech, supposedly, while her free speech is basically just used to promote a completely degenerate agenda. And when it's an exact mirror to the situation in Garland with Pamela Geller and this another attempt at drawing Muhammad, and there's this big furor, this big circus spectacle of shootouts and all this stuff. And again, these all seem to immediately fit into a prepackaged mold, and they're so predictable and so obvious and contain all the same hallmarks that I think it's just obvious what's going on here. It's not a leap of logic to consider the fact that these are dubious people to begin with, especially somebody like Inna Shevchenko. And so for her to be, she's the victim and she emerges as this hero, and she's not a hero. It's a complete lie. It's all phony. And this kind of stuff is just a pattern we consistently see.
Yeah, I mean, they don't only manufacture martyrs, they manufacture our heroes as well. So the social justice warriors and all those that are going to lead the charge against, you know, wickedness and fascism and everything else, right? That's what they do.
Right. Creation of heroes and villains, right?
Yeah, and it's to kind of channel genuine discontent and a genuine anger with what's happening in the world and steer it down in a certain direction so that, you know, we can't have any free agents operating out there and going their own way and gaining popularity. That's why you only see certain people being lifted out in the mainstream media and things like this too, I think.
And it happens. I'm not a leftist, but it happens to any group that is not part of the centralized power structure. So it doesn't matter what your ideology is. You can be, if you're an environmentalist, they are duped and used. If you're part of the IRA, you're duped and used when you, the IRA bombings, right? That's other groups that are involved in that. If you are involved in black Islamic groups in prison and you come out and you're propositioned to do some radical action, you're being used. If you're Timothy McVeigh and you're part of Black Ops and you're part of Elohim City and the far right, you're being used. It's a continual pattern of grooming. I believe Tarpley called it patsies, dupes, and other useful tools. Of course, I don't agree with everything Tarpley says, but I think he's accurate on that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a, just if I can find that here, there was a very good section on this. Let me just play this here.
Well, three men convicted of trying to blow up synagogues in New York have each been sentenced to 25 years in prison. But the cases raised huge controversy after they were actually incited by the FBI and handed fake bombs. Well, critics claim it was a setup, but the judge said her hands were tied. Marina Portnoy has more.
For nearly a decade, the U.S. has waged a widespread global war on terror. It's required a multitasking military effort overseas. On the domestic front, U.S. officials have decided to double down, recently announcing counterterrorism plans that refocus resources on combating homegrown plots.
This is the first counterterrorism strategy that focuses on the ability of Al-Qaeda and its network to inspire people in the United States to attack us from within.
Yet in countless so-called FBI sting operations,
FBI operatives provided the fake C-4 and actually showed them a fake Stinger missile.
The inspiration to attack America has come from a government-paid informant working to orchestrate the plan. A tactic, critics say, exercised in a New York case dubbed Newburgh 4. The suspects, poor, illiterate African-American Muslims, were presented as the faces of homegrown terrorism and subsequently found guilty of conspiring and attempting terrorist attacks against the U.S.
No direction by a foreign entity or a terrorist group.
Instead, direction came from Shahid Hussein, a Pakistani immigrant on the FBI payroll, reportedly paid $100,000 for his services. According to court testimony, Hussein recruited the cash-strapped former convicts by offering cars and cash to carry out the operation.
four individuals that sought to bomb Jewish facilities here in the Bronx and also take down a military aircraft in Newburgh.
Yet, not one defendant had a passport or license. But what the government had was an agent provocateur who testified in court as a key witness.
A guilty verdict for all four men.
Violent Islamic caliphate.
The same day, a new counterterrorism strategy was touted. The Newburgh Four were sentenced to 25 years in prison. A tearful and angered crowd of supporters gathered outside Manhattan's federal courthouse.
Who holds the government accountable? Turn it on your own American citizens, people that's born right here on American soil. This is a damn shame. Miscarriage of justice, and we will keep fighting back.
The government should not be allowed to entrap folks, to make plans, and set the whole course of a complete plan, and then take the victims and sentence them to 25 years in prison.
FBI informants have reportedly been used in dozens of so-called FOIL plots since 9/11. Critics say hundreds of Americans are languishing behind bars for fake terror attacks planted and grown by the U.S. government.
Our tax dollars are being used to incentivize criminals to manufacture terror plots like that they catch other people up in. I can't see how that in any way benefits the country.
That means they can pick anybody out from New York City or across the United States and make a plot.
You have to be very careful, very aware of who you speak to, who you are around, because you have many FBI agents, you have many informants that are out there that they are using.
The U.S. federal judge said outrageous government behavior was exercised in the case of the Newburgh Four, expressing doubt the convicts could have or would have planned an attack without the FBI informant. However, the specific charges against the men require a mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years in prison. Prosecutors say the manufactured plot would have been a colossal attack if carried out. And quote, the fact that it was fake doesn't matter. Marina Portnaya, RT, New York.
Yeah, so there you go. The Newburgh Four. And the thing in there, though, that's interesting is, of course, the way that the government is incentivizing. They're bringing, they're dragging this out of people. But at the same time, they do find individuals, it seems like, that say yes to it, right? They're lured in by something. They say cars or cash or whatever it might be in this case. So it's my point there is that they're not completely innocent. But at the same time, if this is the activity of the government of entrapping people like this, bringing people into this, I mean, then we have to question, you know, what is this really about? And what is the possibility that, you know, Dylan Roof is part of this in some way, that he was cut a deal. He was, as you said, known to the police prior, maybe even some of his friends. I know they were on parole and things like that. So they might have been influenced in some way to just kind of go along and play along with that. We just don't know at this point.
Correct. We don't know enough of those details. As I've learned from covering situations and stories on the scene, that's very crucial. It's always very crucial to be on the scene, which is why media at least used to do that. Now they just do green screens and make up stories. But in the past, it was more standard to be on the scene. And that's because there's so much possibility for deception, for twisting of narratives and so forth. But absolutely, we don't know all the details. But I do think, as with Charlie Hebdo, we have seen enough fishy elements in this to raise legitimate questions.
Yep, exactly. Now, let's see where this goes next then. I mean, what the next steps are going to be. I think the trial was set for October. There's going to be a number of spectacles, I think, in South Carolina and Charleston. It was like Obama was going to want to go there, and he knew, I think, the Reverend as well personally, and there was some interesting connection and ties there. But what do you think is going to be next in the process here, and where might it go next in terms of, and whatever you want to pick up on that, if it's the political system or just the vibe overall or any developments? What do you think?
Well, I expect more of the same. I think the branding of this as the Summer of Rage, and we saw, you know, the black mob attacks in the past few summers. I expect more of that.
And sorry, by the way, you brought that up. There was one in Charleston, by the way, in April, I think, late April, that wasn't recorded for some reason as well, but it was from WMCA or something, not YMCA. There was another one organization, but nonetheless, these are the kinds of things that would kind of happening in the background of all of this that people, at least on the national level, don't know about, that there are things that occur, and then it just seems like one of these events kind of spring up out of the blue, out of nowhere, when that clearly is not the case.
I'm always reminded of the 2007, 2005 British Ministry of Defense document predicting the next few decades. Revolution, flash mobs, and brain chips, a grim vision of the future. And so you read this, and it's just, it's exactly what we're seeing. I mean, they even talk about the rise of a version of Marxism. And that's exactly what we're seeing, even though it may not be called Marxism. It's a color revolution under a different name, Marxism under a different name, Black Lives Matter, these different memes. All of these are just marketing strategies of engineered revolution. So that's worth checking out. So that what the white papers say is coming in the next 10 to 15 years is what I would respond to that question with. So more revolutions, more flash mobs, and a grim vision of the future.
Great. Yeah. No, we'll see what happens. What's your point of action in this? I guess is if you, and I'm not saying you're taking this, but the stance, but if we view everything as being kind of, I guess, controlled or opposition or whatnot, how do you think we act within that and react and respond, I guess, is a better point in this of obviously trying to prevent what's happening and without falling into traps and being manipulated and controlled, because I still think there need to be a concerted effort of trying to halt everything that's going on here, because it's not taking us in a good direction.
I don't mean to oversimplify the world as if there's only one actor and we're all just sort of fighting one single actor. I mean, there are power blocks and there are battles and competing worldviews and competing cartels and power structures and so forth. So I don't want to oversimplify things in that regard. Certainly I agree that resistance is necessary and mandatory. I mean, there's not any other option. I mean, if you don't resist, you're going to absolutely be assimilated into the Borg.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you have to resist if you have any degree, I think, of intelligence or self-will, self-motivation, self-confidence, et cetera, et cetera. I would agree, I think, with Dugin's strategy of uniting in any way with any groups that oppose philosophical liberalism. I agree with that strategy.
Right.
I mean, I don't necessarily adhere to everything that he would say. But I think there's just no other option. I mean, we have to not so much worry about infiltrators or this or that, or worry about erecting some large group, but a large number of individual actors opposing the system could affect change. And I think that's why they're doing these things. They wouldn't be doing these things if they weren't worried about opposition.
Exactly. I mean, yeah.
You don't do these kinds of things and then have to spend billions of dollars in the media spinning it in a different way, creating narratives, if you weren't worried about controlling everyone. So they have to be concerned, or else it wouldn't be going on. So I would say, do as best as you can as an individual actor. Form as many alliances as you can with those who in any way oppose the existing liberal establishment. And yet at the same time, be wary of radical ideologues. Don't be too ideological in your approach. We don't live in an ideal world. And a lot of these patsies and dupes are people who are idealistic, right? And when we're in our young or early 20s, we're very idealistic. We don't have a sense of realpolitik and pragmatism. So we need a dose of that. But at the same time, to not be caught up in utopian promises by demagogues.
Well said. Now, I think it's clear that, you know, people are waking up on different levels to the multitude of agendas going on out there. And I think with the recent, you know, pointing fingers and what have you, and the almost uniform response by the media and the same type of rhetoric and dialogue and whatnot, it's clear that they are obviously, you know, worried about people that are concerned with the type of things that they're now are kind of associating with this event and trying to make them morally reprehensible. And this is the big enemy and we have to go after these people. And I think there's even conferences now coming up in Hungary on how, and they chose Hungary, of course, because they are more nationalistic there and they wanted to have a concerted effort in place on how to stop this, basically. So this, it's interesting. We'll see where this goes and what the next level to this is going to be.
A good example, if we think about Soviet strategies in the U.S., what they would tend to do is fund and support any group. It didn't matter what the ideology was. Any group that was against the existing power structure. I think there's some wisdom in that we could glean in response. So, you know, try as best you can to form alliances with any group that is out of step with the existing establishment. And granted, many of them are bought off and co-opted. But one good thing, shining spot in this, is that as things get worse, I think in that upper yuppie level, many of those people are going to get screwed over.
They already are, I think.
And as people get more and more and more progressively screwed over by this existing structure, they're going to be forced to wake up. And so I think that'll be a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. Now, as you said, it's not about perfection at every level or at agreeing with everyone at every level either. I don't think it's about that. It's about realizing that the path we're on is that is so severe of what the end destination of this is, that it's important, just as you say, to work with people who you might not see eye to eye on every single issue, but the very aspect of trying to see that common ground or what the common goals are, and at least up to that point, work together, you know, try to help each other out, and realize what is at stake here, and try to let, you know, petty differences behind us for now anyway, because you know, all that can be sorted out later. We don't have the time and the luxury to deal with all these petty details.
Exactly.
Right now.
And this is what they do. What do they do? They make alliances that are necessary for the furtherance of their agenda. They don't worry so much about petty differences, and that's how they make progress. And they've done it for centuries. We have to do the same thing. We have to do that.
I don't think they even worry about ideology, because it's not about that. They use whatever ideology they can to advance their cause, you know?
Right.
The
Soviet strategy of psychological warfare in the U.S. is again, a great example of that. And so they would fund any kind of movement, whether it was independent, libertarian, in some cases, leftist, or New Age, or in any way, in any way in opposition to the establishment, because that would then create destabilization in the social realm. And so, you know, in a way, that's kind of what the alternative media is already doing for the existing establishment. That's kind of happening. And so we're seeing this response from them in that regard. So I would say we just keep charging forward is our best bet.
All right. Very good. Good job, Jay. Now, there's, of course, a lot more to the case. Hopefully more things will become known. And we haven't certainly covered all of it here. There's a lot more to it than that. But is there anything important that you think we've left out, either just pertaining to the case itself or something surrounding that we should get to before we start to wrap up here for today?
Looking over my notes here, I think we covered all the high points. So I think it was a great discussion. And thank you for having me on.
Well, you bet. Thank you, Jay. And please give us your website and let us know if there's anything new you have upcoming and how people can you know, follow or get a hold of you.
Yes, my site is jaysanalysis.com. I try to write every day, so most days I do have new posts up. I do still offer a subscription service somewhat similar to your own, a little more low tech than yours, but I do full interviews with different types of people out there that I think are intellectual and have something to offer. And I also do philosophy lectures for subscription as well. So that offers a way to get an introduction to the classics of the Western tradition that are not tainted by statist Marxism that you'll get in your public school. So if listeners are interested, they can go to my page and subscribe to that, as well as read through hundreds of articles I've got on everything from geopolitics to film analysis to philosophy to comparative religion, you name it.
Very good. Lots of good stuff there for you, ladies and gentlemen. JaceAnalysis.com. We'll have the link up. Thank you so much again, Jay. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk more soon.
All right. Thank you, Henry.
Much more is coming up on Dylann Roof and the shootings at the AME Church in Charleston and the many strange inconsistencies and things that aren't making sense at this stage. We are pulling this together as fast as we possibly can, as there is an urgency in regards to how this event is being used. In terms of our radio program, we're going to be back on Friday with Kurt Doolittle on propertarianism, an interesting program. Don't miss that. But I wish you have a wonderful rest of your day or evening, wherever you're at. And we'll be back soon again. Thank you for listening. And don't forget, redicemembers.com is the place where you can enjoy our full archives with much more radio and videos. Take care, stay safe, and stay brave. Continue to speak out about the lies and fabrications and how the establishment is seeking to use them against us.
I rode with old Jeb Stuart and his band of Southern horse. There never were no Yankees who could beat us force to force. No, they never did defeat us, but we never could evade their dirty foreign politics and cowardly blockade. Well, we hadn't any powder, and we hadn't any shot. We hadn't any money to buy what we ain't got. So we rode our worn out horses and we ate on plain cornmeal. And we licked them where we caught them with Southern guts and steel. Well, we sunk the ship at Sumter and we broke her plumb in two. And we showed them bully Yankees just what we aim to do. At a little creek called Bull Run, we took their starry rag to wipe our horses down with, and I ain't here to brag. Well, there aren't as many left of us as rode out at the start. And then there are the weary, weak, and body sad of heart. We fought a fight to tell about, and I am here to say, I'd climb my horse and follow Marsh to hell come any day.